Health and Social Service Committee to order at this time. It is now 1:33. We have present all members except Senator Ellis, who's not able to be with us today. And we have two bills that's going to come before us, and we're going to get down to business real quick here because I know you have busy schedules. First of all, I want to say that you have a cell phone. I'd like for you to cut them off so that we don't have that disruption. And I also just want to recognize the new people that's going to be working with the committee. And they tell me Nancy Jones, we have, and we also have, and I can't see your name on here, Heather. And the last name is Parker?
Yeah.
Heather Parker. And we're glad to have you working with us. We have Senate Bill 172 that's going to come up with this CARE directive. Do not resuscitate. And it is a bill that's sponsored by Senator Dyson, which I am a co-sponsor of. And I know he has other agendas. So are you going to go down and sit before us, or are you just going to have your staff to come up?
Yeah, my staff will come. I'll make an opening statement.
Yes, you can make it from there, or you can go here.
All right, thank you. This is my chief of staff, Charles Kopp. Those of you have been, and it's all of you have been around for a while, realize that when state codes are revised, sometimes that there's old code there and the new stuff gets slotted in, and sometimes in retrospect there's some ambiguities. And this purpose of this bill is to correct possible ambiguities that have shown up in the end of life decisions in the statute. And this is to make sure that the intent of the legislation, legislature is followed when it comes to end-of-life decisions, and it protects patient rights, and it has to do with what's often known in the trade as DNRs, or do not resuscitate orders. And it has always been true, I think, in the medical profession and in medical institutions, to that the patient's wishes always predominate. That's what is going to be done. And in the case of an incompetent patient, that's a patient that cannot communicate, then responsibility falls to family members, and particularly to authorized surrogates. Yeah, we passed this Presence Act, Healthcare Decisions Act, in 2004. And the legislature changed some provisions in Alaska Statute 13.52.120 in establishing a presumption in favor of life, as in when there's a question of what should be done medically, the presumption always is to preserve the life of the patient. And when you read that in its entirety, we believe it can and should be interpreted to allow the patient or their authorized representative to prevent a physician from issuing a DNR order, but there's ambiguities in the chapter, and it could result in other interpretations. And our office ended up involved in a case in one hospital where that was happening, and there was some contention about what medically should be done. And there's ambiguities in this case resulted in a lot of angst and anxiety for both the patient and the patient's, the person who had the durable power of attorney for them. So what we're doing here with this bill, it clarifies the authority of DNR decisions with respect to the patient and physicians, amends the Alaska Care Directive form to allow patients to accept or refuse life-sustaining procedures. And I'm going to have my chief of staff, Mr. Kopp, go through this at any level of which you all require. And we believe that we have touched bases with the relevant medical authorities, at least some of them, and don't believe at this point that there's any pushback against it. But indeed, there's always that possibility. And there is another committee referral to judiciary in case something comes up after our committee acts on it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Senators. The sectional analysis as part of your packet gives a summary of the bill which is in front of you, and I invite at any time just to have me pause and further explain, but I'll get right into it. The Section 1 of the bill amends AS 1352-045, which deals with withholding or withdrawing of life-sustaining procedures, and that amends it to prohibit a healthcare institution or healthcare facility from interpreting the issuance of a do-not-resuscitate order as preventing the provision of life-sustaining procedures to the patient. In other words, they can continue to give assisted ventilation, antibiotics, treat infection, and things like that that would fall under definition of life-sustaining, even if a DNR is in place. Section 2 amends 1352-060, obligations of healthcare providers, institutions, and facilities, to prohibit a healthcare provider from declining for reasons of conscience to comply with a do not resuscitate order that is consistent with this chapter. It also states that the subsection does not allow a healthcare provider, healthcare institution, or healthcare facility to decline to comply with an individual instruction or a healthcare decision that requests that cardiopulmonary resuscitation or other resuscitative measures be provided. Section 3 amends AS 1352-060F, which is obligations of healthcare providers, institutions, and facilities, stating that the subsection does not allow a healthcare provider, healthcare institution, or healthcare facility to decline to comply with an advanced healthcare directive or a healthcare decision that is consistent with this chapter, and that requests that cardiopulmonary resuscitation or other resuscitative measures be provided. The subsection addresses declining to comply with an individual instruction or a healthcare decision that requires medically ineffective healthcare or healthcare contrary to generally accepted healthcare standards. And I would bring to the committee's attention at this time that on page 2 of the bill, we were recently notified by our legal department that there was an error in drafting that is easily corrected. But going to drawing your attention to line 13, where it says decline to comply with an advanced healthcare directive, that term should be within individual instruction, and that is to make it consistent with line 9 above, where it talks about an individual instruction or a healthcare decision. Individual instruction is a slightly narrower term coming directly from the individual.
And I would say that we do have Terry Bannister online. Should the committee have anything that they want to ask of her, she's available to answer.
Thank you, Chair.
You continue.
Thank you. In Section 4, this amends 1352-065A, Do Not Resuscitate Protocol and Identification Requirements, and states that a physician may issue a DNR order for a patient of the physician only as provided in this section. Section 5 amends 1352-065B to require that the protocol adopted by the Department of Health and Social Services for withholding CPR comply with 1352-065, which again is the Do Not Resuscitate Protocol. Those subsections are added new to this bill in Section 6, and they include subsections G, H, I, and J. In brief, G prohibits a physician from issuing a Do Not Resuscitate order for a patient of the physician without the express consent described in this subsection, except as provided in H. Going down to subsection H states that when a physician may issue a do not resuscitate order for a patient of the physician without the express consent required by G of this section. Again, it states when a physician may issue a do not resuscitate order. And subsection H expressly states that a physician may issue a do not resuscitate order without the express consent required in G, which is the default, must come from the patient. If the patient does not have capacity, no one is authorized to make a healthcare decision for the patient, and one, the patient has an advanced healthcare directive which indicates the patient wants a do not resuscitate order, or two, the patient has an advanced healthcare directive which is silent about the issuance of a do not resuscitate order, and another physician concurs in the decision to issue a do not resuscitate order. Subsection I, 1352-065I, requires a physician to revoke a do not resuscitate order issued for a patient under listed circumstances. And those circumstances are if the DNR order violates G of this section. And of course, G is the default, which states that you cannot issue a DNR order without the express consent of the patient. So if it violates section G, they will revoke the DNR. Or two, if the patient has capacity and they request the DNR be revoked. Or three, the patient has an advanced health care directive that indicates the patient does not want a DNR order. Four, the patient does not have capacity and the patient does not have an advanced health care directive that indicates the patient wants a DNR order, and a person authorized to make health care decisions for the patient requests or does not oppose the revocation of the do not resuscitate order. And then finally, the fifth condition under which a physician shall revoke a DNR order for a patient is if a patient is under 18 years of age and the parent or guardian of the patient requests that the do not order, that the do not resuscitate order be revoked. Under the final subsection J, that allows a physician to revoke a do not resuscitate order issued by another physician under certain described circumstances, and that identifies the physician-patient relationships that should be in place, physician-patient relationship with the patient, an individual relationship with the patient, or by virtue of your employment at the healthcare institution, or your being their medical provider. Section 7 amends 1352.080, which is immunities, to replace a citation to a subsection that is repealed by this bill. And that is 1352.065F, which is repealed. And we have this new subsection, which we've just gone through. Section 8 amends 1352.080C to provide that its immunity provisions do not apply if a do not resuscitate order relied on by the healthcare provider, healthcare institution, or healthcare facility was issued in violation of AS 1352.065, which is the new subsection we've just gone through in Section 4 dealing with the Do Not Resuscitate Protocol. In Section 9, it amends 1352.120B, which is the effect of this chapter, to clarify that a violation of the new provisions added by Section 6 does not, in the context of the provisions required consistency with the chapter, constitute a homicide. And it adds a cross-reference to the new subsection H as an exception for applying this subsection's approach to suicide or homicide. Dropping down into Section 10, we address the new Section H, where it states that the provisions in B, which exclude homicide and suicide as being a prosecutorial offense, states that the provisions in B about homicide and suicide do not apply to a person who orders or causes the withholding or withdrawal of life-sustaining procedures and acts intentionally, recklessly, with criminal negligence, or with gross negligence. And that's as defined in AS 1181-900. Those terms are legally defined. Section 11 amends the optional form, the Advanced Health Care Directive form and patient selections, which is provided in statute at 1352.300, to add an additional section regarding the patient's wishes on life-sustaining procedures. And I would just direct your attention to page 13 of the bill, where you see that spelled out. In our review with legal, there really wasn't a section in the form that made it clear where a patient could choose to receive or not receive life-sustaining procedures, which are defined as any medical treatment, procedure, or intervention that may keep you alive but will not remove your terminal condition or remove permanent unconsciousness. It goes on to define life-sustaining procedures as assisted ventilation, renal dialysis, surgical procedures, blood transfusions, and administration of drugs, including antibiotics or artificial nutrition and hydration. Things short of intervention, but that will certainly aid in your comfort and care in a process that you are otherwise terminal. And finally, Section 12 lists definitions. The definitions for healthcare decision is expanded to include a direction relating to the provision of cardiopulmonary resuscitation or other resuscitative measures. Section 13 repeals the old AS 1352-065F, which currently addresses how DNR orders are made ineffective. And Section 14 adds a provision to indicate how do not resuscitate orders made before the bill's effective date are to be treated in light of this bill. And that's a conclusion of the brief overview. Thank you, Chair.
All right, thank you very much. Are there any questions from the committee at this time? And Terry, is there any explanation you would like to give? Or are you just here to answer questions?
No, I have no comment.
All right, thank you.
The only thing I would say is that the correction we need to make is, I think the term is broader than the other term, but it doesn't really matter. It's just trying to parallel what was previously said. So it doesn't really matter substantively.
You're getting feedback there, but we heard what you said, so we can move on. We do have at least one person that signed up to speak to this bill, and Dr. Holberg, would you want to come forward at this time? We'll open up a public testimony. Anyone that have not signed up that's in the room, you may do so now. And I don't know if we have any offline folks signed up at this time. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Ward Hurlbert. I'm the Director of the Division of Public Health and the Chief Medical Officer for the Department of Health and Social Services for the state of Alaska. I'll just be brief, and I'll be glad to respond to any questions. I have reviewed the bill. By way of explanation, I do have a background of several times serving as a hospital administrator and also as a clinician in the hospital. But I'm not an attorney. But from my reading of the bill, it's very consistent with what I would have expected and the practices that we had in the hospitals that I led and in my role as a clinician. It does clarify that the intent of the patient or their surrogate is primary. I think that's customary across our country. Our default judgment usually is to prolong life when there's a question there. Sometimes that does bring pain and suffering, but that's generally the way we do to, I think, with the intent of protecting people. So that the bill does look reasonable and appropriate, very consistent with my past experience. There is no fiscal note on the bill, and I guess we're not considering this. The cost on it will be very small, but such that I think that the division can quite adequately absorb that without any additional funding on that. So I'll be glad to respond to any questions, Madam Chair.
Any questions? Well, we want to thank you for coming forward and thank you for your testimony. I also want to take this opportunity to thank Senator Dyson for bringing the bill forward. This was some concerns that I've had along the way, and so when he came up with the bill, it was quite helpful for me to join in with him to bring this before us. Senator Dyson, is there any other comments or remarks you want to make? We don't have anyone sign up, and I do want to say, though, that we did send it to the Medical Association. We think we got the word out pretty much that there were going to be hearings today. This bill does have another referral. It'll go to judiciary, so if there are any technicalities that need to be dealt with, they could be dealt with there. I don't think anyone could say from a health standpoint that there's much need to hold the bill, except we might want to get more testimony if you would like to do that. We can bring the bill back on Wednesday and give more opportunities since it was only Thursday that we posted this bill. And a lot of people might not have had a chance to sign up. Any comments?
Well, and we also have done this in collaboration with one of the major health providers here, and I had sent them copies as well, inquired this morning and was not able to make contact with them. I would prefer to have the bill moved because I'd like to get it through both houses. But you have my word that if any problems come up, I will try to get them dealt with in judiciary, or if necessary, referred back to this committee to deal with.
Okay, I really don't have a problem with trying to move the bill forward because we did not have anybody to call in or email us and say that they had some opposition to this. And if there are other testimonies to be done, they could be done at the next committee or referral. I'll see if any of the members have any closing remarks, or how do you feel about this bill being moved? Because we do have enough people. I'd like to have a motion to move it.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 172 to the next committee of referral.
And there is no fiscal
note. With attached fiscal note of zero.
All right, thanks. I think that's probably unanimous, and at this point, then we will move this to judiciary. Thank you very much. We have another bill that's going to come before us, and I see that Senator Giesel's there in the audience, and she has her staff with her. Would you please come forward and present your bill? It's Senate Bill 144, State Immunization Program.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate you hearing the bill, and I also appreciate you noting the importance of this bill with your gracious co-sponsorship of it. In 1751, a 19-year-old young man named George Washington joined his older brother in Barbados. This was the same George Washington who would eventually become General George Washington and finally President George Washington. While he was in Barbados, he contracted a disease called smallpox. Now, he was young and healthy, and so in 3 weeks he recovered from this. He now had lifelong immunity to this disease that often became an epidemic in those days. Later, during the Revolutionary War, an epidemic of smallpox was going through the colonies. General Washington understood the value of inoculation, which was new science, new technology in those days, and he instituted a policy to inoculate his soldiers. In doing so, he saved hundreds of lives of military folks, as well as encouraging colonists to receive the inoculation. Some historians believe that policy of inoculation and rapid response to the smallpox epidemic was actually George Washington's most strategic decision of his military career. Interesting. Now, as I look around the room, those of us who are senators in this room have been vaccinated for smallpox. That was that vaccine you got on the back of your arm that formed a scab and left a scar. That vaccine is no longer given. It was discontinued in the early 1970s in the U.S. because we had not had any cases of smallpox because of our vaccination program. Then later in the 80s, the rest of the world discontinued vaccinating for this disease. It was wiped out, essentially, through effective vaccination. Now, in a couple months in Anchorage, we're going to celebrate the Iditarod Sled Dog Race. The original name for this race was the Great Race of Mercy. This was a relay race of sled dog teams taking serum to Nome, a city that was being decimated by diphtheria. Diphtheria. If I were to ask you, what is diphtheria? I suspect most of you wouldn't know. It's a disease that affects the upper airway, forms a membrane across the airway, and actually folks suffocate to death. In the old days, mothers would treat their children by coaxing them to swallow a strip of fabric, a strip of cloth, and then the mother would extract that piece of cloth to pull out that membrane so the child could continue to breathe. Imagine doing that. Today we don't see this disease because our children are vaccinated in a disease, in a vaccine called diphtheria, tetanus, that's lockjaw, pertussis, and that's whooping cough. It's a combined vaccine that kids get. And so we don't see diphtheria anymore. When I was a child, I remember two kids down the street, two little boys who died of polio. This was up in Fairbanks. We don't see that happening anymore either. There's only a few places in the world where polio still exists because we have an effective vaccine program. I had the privilege of serving as a Senate intern to Senator Ted Stevens early in his career. Now, we honor Ted Stevens for many things, but one thing you may not know about him is that he cared deeply about the health of Alaskans. We know that he provided funding for clean water and wastewater treatment in rural Alaska, but he also provided generous funding for the state of Alaska to have a substantial vaccine program. Well, we had that substantial vaccine program for about 30 years. It provided what we call a universal availability of these vaccines. In other words, the state, with this federal money, was able to purchase the vaccines at a very low cost because of this large purchasing power, and provide the vaccines to providers, both private and public providers, throughout the state. Well, in 2008, the Centers for Disease Control noted that Alaska seemed to be overgenerously funded, and they've begun a cutback of our federal funds. So we are experiencing a cutback from $4.3 million to fund this program to $700,000 in next year's budget. This significant cutback has been gradual since 2008, but because of it, the state has discontinued providing vaccines for adults and for underinsured children. Funding is still in existence for certain children, Medicaid-eligible, Alaska Native, American Indian, et cetera. But we estimate that there's approximately 47,000 underinsured children in the state who will be affected by this reduction of vaccine availability. So that's where SB 144 comes in. What this bill would do is provide state funding to fill that gap. Now, it's a temporary bill. It would only be in effect until 2015. This would give us time to craft other options for funding, and there are other options available that I will be pursuing. So, Madam Chair, if it would be all right with you, I want to introduce Mr. Jonathan Taylor. Jonathan is a University of Alaska student intern in my office this session, and he's going to go through the sectional analysis, if that's all right, Mrs. Chair.
Madam Chair. That is fine.
Good afternoon, Senators, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Jonathan Taylor, and I'm an intern in Senator Giesel's office. And I'm just going to briefly go through the sectional analysis. Section 1 provides a statement of legislative intent pertaining to the Child and Adult Immunization Program, which is established in Section 2 of the bill. And it includes a summary of the past and future of the program and emphasizes the temporary nature of the program. Section 2 establishes the Child and Adult Immunization Program in the Department of Health and Social Services that requires the department to determine eligibility, adopt regulations, and apply for available funds. It establishes standards for provider and recipient participation in the program and the types of vaccinations covered. Section 3 of the Act authorizes immediate adoption of regulations by the Department of Health and Social Services. Section 4 establishes a delayed repeal of the Act, which would end June 30th, 2015, the end of fiscal year 2015. And Section 5 provides an immediate effective date.
Okay, we've had the section on that. I know we have quite a few people signed up to testify on this bill, and we're going to open it up for public testimony at this time. Unless you have something else you want to add?
Madam Chair, there were two folks that I actually had asked if they would testify particularly, and that's Dr. Roz Singleton and Dr. George Rainier. I believe they're online. Both of them.
Rainier is on here, and the other one might be also. Who was the second person?
Roz Singleton. She is a pediatrician and a state epidemiologist.
So far, I don't see her name forward, but if she comes, we'll let her
all
testify.
Right.
Also. Oh, here she is. Rosalind.
She's here, available in Anchorage.
If it's all right, Madam Chair, they were particularly asked to speak. Yes, thank you.
Go first.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, we'll start with Rosalind.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate this chance to speak on this committee. And as a longtime Alaska pediatrician, I'm representing the American Academy of Pediatrics here in Alaska to testify in support of Senate Bill 144. I've worked in pediatrics for 30 years before vaccines for HIB and hepatitis A were available. I treated many cases of children and saw children die from these diseases. Before vaccines, Alaska experienced massive epidemics of hepatitis A, with as many as 4,000 symptomatic persons. Since vaccine in 1995, our rate of hepatitis A is now one of the lowest in the country. And similarly, we currently have no measles outbreak in the state since 1997. But any decrease in MMR vaccine could endanger this fragile protection. What will happen if this bill doesn't pass? If this bill doesn't pass, next year, the state immunization program will no longer provide any vaccines except for children who are eligible for vaccine to the Vaccine for Children program for Medicaid, Alaska Natives, and uninsured children. When faced with the cost of a vaccine, many parents who do not know their insurance status will defer vaccines. This will lead to an even lower coverage rate than Alaska currently has and will make us susceptible to outbreaks of measles and other infections. Mm. I want to give my wholehearted support for this bill, and thank you very much for allowing me to testify.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Hearing none, we'll go now to Judge Rainier.
Yes, this is Dr. George Rainier. I am the Legislative Affairs Chairman for Alaska Physicians and Surgeons, which is a large physician group in Anchorage. I have been practicing in Anchorage for 40 years, and I and my children and my friends' children and friends' adults have all benefited from the fact that there has been a very good vaccine program in this state. Alaska Physicians and Surgeons is very intent on maintaining the health of the Alaskan population. And Alaska Physicians and Surgeons wholeheartedly supports this bill, and we will be providing a letter of support to confirm this conversation. Madam Chairman, thank you very much for allowing me to testify, and thank you, Senators, for listening to my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions from the committee? Hearing none, I'll go now to Randy Sweet. Randy Sweet.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Randy Sweet, and I'm with United Way of Anchorage. United Way of Anchorage supports SB 144 and the stopgap funding for the Alaska Immunization Program and thorough framing and analysis to develop a long-term funding resolution so that vulnerable children and adults are able to receive needed vaccines. United Way of Anchorage is working with our partners so Anchorage residents have access to quality health care and practice healthy behaviors. Access to vaccines is critical to individual health and wellness and to public health. By providing access to vaccines, children are able to stay healthy, start school, and stay in school. Adults are able to stay on the job both because their children are healthy and they are healthy. From an economic development standpoint, a healthy Alaska is attractive to companies considering locating their businesses here and remaining here. Lastly, our Constitution states that the legislature shall provide for the promotion and protection of public health. By providing this temporary solution, the legislature is able to promote prevention of illness and protect the public health of Alaskans from unnecessary exposure to and spreading of disease. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Hearing none, we'll continue with the public testimony. Mary Sullivan?
Yes, I'm here.
Yes.
afternoon, Madam Chair, Senators. My name, for the record, is Mary Sullivan. I'm with the Alaska Primary Care Association. We support the passage of SB 144, as has already been testified about the merits of immunization and prevention of outbreaks. Additionally, I was having some conversations with some of our community health center clinicians about this issue, and the consensus is that if faced caught with the expensive costs of purchasing the serums themselves, they will probably have to decrease significantly the amounts of vaccinations that they're able to provide. One clinic today told me they've already overspent their budget for the vaccines that they're providing in Talkeetna, the Sunshine Community Health Center Clinic. And with the increases of the two-year-old vaccines, you know, there's new requirements for the vaccines for the two-year-olds. And they said they expect to be zero compliant, even though they've already purchased, overspent their budget on their vaccines, and are trying as much as they can to provide the vaccines to the uninsured children in that area. They expect zero compliance. They thought that perhaps children would be able to get vaccines through the schools. That's not happening. So that's just one story. Of course, there's many more like that. So we support the passage of SB 144 and would be happy to take any questions if you have any.
Thanks for your testimony. Any questions? Here are none. We'll go on and we'll go now to Ward, Dr. Ward Hilbert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Ward Hilbert. I'm the Director of the Division of Public Health and the Chief Medical Officer of the Department of Health and Social Services. The administration is fine with the concept and the overall policy in the bill. The fiscal note is still being worked out. Vaccines are extremely expensive. They're getting more so. And we need to have a fiscal note that we can trim as much as we can and be as responsible as we can. I think Senator Giesel's presentation was absolutely eloquent on the history of immunizations there. I first started practicing in Alaska as a physician in Dillingham in 1961, before we had these vaccines. And when we had measles outbreaks, we had kids die with measles pneumonia, measles encephalitis, the other complications of that, and the other diseases. More recently, where the immunization rates in a number of places have tended down, in California, they had over 2,000 kids with pertussis, with whooping cough, and in 2010 had 10 infants die. Two of them had had one shot, the others had had no shots at all. So far, we have dodged those bullets in Alaska, but our immunization rates have not been what they should be. We were number 49 among all the states a couple of years ago. We've been trying to put effort into that, educating folks, educating parents. There are more shots than my kids had to have when they were little, or your kids, because there are more shots. They do good. They've also become very expensive, and there are reasons for that. We're up to number 42 among the states. Now Mississippi's number one. And I tell my counterpart there, we're chasing them. But we would like to at least get up in the near-term future. What we're talking about in the bill, as Senator Giesel pointed out, about half of the kids in our state are eligible for federally funded vaccines under the Vaccines for Children's program, either being Alaska Native or being on Medicaid. We also estimate about a quarter of the kids in our state have coverage through private insurance for vaccines. So that leaves about a quarter of the kids. And that's what this is targeting now. From a public health standpoint, if you do not have an immunization rate of around 80%, you don't have what we call herd immunity. That means not only is there risk to those who haven't received vaccines, there's risk to the population there. If you can achieve that level of immunization, you pretty well protect the community. One of the things, again, that I don't feel real good about, and we're working on with education, we have the highest percentage of parental refusers. It's called parental hesitancy here, about 9%. We have the highest of any state, and so we're working on dealing with that. What we just heard from Ms. Sullivan warmed my heart that they're out of vaccine in Talkeetna, because that's been one of our most challenging communities. And the physicians and the public health nurses and the others who've gone there deserve a lot of credit if we're seeing that change there. So this is a need for the state. We're trying to be as innovative as we can in finding sources of payment for the vaccine, but they do make a difference. They do save the lives of children, and as I say, we're working on the fiscal note to be as responsible as we can, but conceptually, this is something we appreciate. I'll be glad to take any questions.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Any questions? I'll just add to what you said. I did talk with the commissioner today. I know there's something being worked out as far as the fiscal note, and so therefore we don't have one before us. He's expect to have something back to us, maybe even by Wednesday. I don't know for sure if that's going to happen, but I know that it's been worked on. And so there are a couple other people to testify on the bill that I didn't get around to. Chuck Wheeler, are you still there?
Yes, Senator.
Would you like to testify? You may testify at this time. We can't hear you.
Hello?
Hello? Are you hearing me?
Yes, I am.
Okay, you may testify at this time.
Yes, thank you, Senator Davis.
You're welcome.
I support Senate Bill 144. Well, last year, I brought this attention to our local representative through the office, and I thought something would become of it. Fortunately, a year later, we're hearing about it. The state was notified in 2008 of these funding cuts. Last year, we knew about the 317 federal funding. Now, this year, we're more informed about the children, the other fund. There's two funding sources. I don't have that other one in front of me, but the costs keep escalating. The population of children has gone up. When you look at the statistics, there's something like a 20% increase. I'm sorry, 14,000 in 5 years. Okay, you're looking at 2,400 a year. The funding decrease is considerable. So it's up here in Alaska, Northwest Alaska, we have the highest rate of hepatitis and other diseases, according to the public health nurse. Not only that, our population, like here in Nome, is 50% white and 50% Native. Now, understandably, the Natives do get this funding. However, the vaccines aren't available. If you're in Anchorage, you can get them, but they're not available here in Nome. When the supplies run out, they're gone. That was, I was told this last year. So it would behoove our representatives to look into the local, regional needs that they have here. And people that are uninsured, whether they're Native or non-Native, particularly the uninsured, their ER bill is bad enough. And as far as getting a vaccine, it's totally out of their budget. So I would suggest that something be done along those lines, and I would appreciate passage of this to make up the difference and get this Alaska immunization program back on track to where it covers, because prevention is the name of the game, and we don't need the cost of the disease once they catch it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chuck. Any questions of Mr. Wheeler? Here, none. There's one other person that signed up here in Juneau. I'm not able to read your name. It looked like George, but I'm not sure. Is there anyone in the audience that signed up to speak? Okay, come on up. Also, I know who you are. I just he wrote in shorthand.
Madam Chair, thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Brown. So I don't have to ask your voice questions.
George, thank you. Glad to have you before us.
Thank you, Senator Davis and committee members. I'm George Brown. I'm a pediatrician for over 40 years, most of them in Alaska. I live at 1640 2nd Street in Douglas. And I want to ask four questions that relate to this bill, and I'm very strongly in favor of its passage. I can answer most of the questions, but there are some that need to be looked into that have to do with cost. And these questions are based on practical experience recently in Alaska. First question is, what are the costs of the DTaP vaccine? That's the vaccine that prevents whooping cough. And what were the medical costs of the whooping cough outbreak here in Juneau and Southeast in 2007-2008, the cost per child? I have part of an answer. The answer for the vaccine then was about $2.40 per child. I hope you will get the answer about the medical cost per child from the Division of Public Health. I looked for it online as best I could, and I could not secure it in a short time. Second question is, what were the costs of the H1N1 influenza vaccine and the medical costs of the treatment during the 2009-2010 influenza season per child in Alaska? The cost for the vaccine was about $3.20. I hope you can get the cost for the medical, both outpatient and hospital, from DPH. The third question I've got a solid answer for based on much data done earlier by pediatricians, the Academy of Pediatrics. What are the cost savings for the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine? The answer is $16 for every dollar invested. The fourth question is, what is the Universal Childhood Vaccine Program of Washington State? The answer is, it's a pooling of federal, private insurance, and state of Washington public health funds to assure that all Washington State children receive all the recommended immunizations. That program has been going on for a while, and I have their website in the I'll leave this with you, the statement. Thank you very much. If you have questions, I'd love to try to answer them.
Well, we certainly thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions? And I would like for you to leave that information with us. We could get answers to that, and I'm familiar with the Washington State program, and I think that's a good program, and it might be something that our administration might want to consider. When you bring all those groups together, we might be able to do the 100% of all our children. We know the importance of this bill, and I appreciate Senator Giesel bringing it forward. She's hoping that the situation can be worked out by 2015, but at this point, we just got to figure out how much money is going to go in there this year, because it's in the million, and you know they have different figures coming from the administration, so they got to get together and work that out. So hopefully we'll come back Wednesday and have more information on that, and also have the answers to the questions that you have asked. I don't think there's anybody in this room that don't understand that this is a very important bill, and we need to do all that we can to make sure all our children get the immunizations that they need, and not just be dependent on what we get out of Medicaid or what the Native children might be able to get out of their programs. So once again, I want to thank you for bringing the bill forward. Is there anyone else in the audience that want to testify? And I think I see Senator Egan's hand. Do you have a comment or a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a question, and I'm assuming it was for Dr. Herbert, and it's on page 3 of the bill, section 2, and subsection F1. And I'm just curious about your reasoning for exempting meningitis.
The vaccines have become increasingly more and more expensive. We estimate to immunize an infant through the 2 years for all the recommended vaccines is getting up close to $1,800. So these two were exempted for a couple of reasons. They're very costly vaccines, and the cost-benefit ratio, the protection from them, the cost-benefit ratio is not as good. Overall, with most of the childhood vaccines, as Dr. Brown just quoted, the savings in medical costs are about $8 and something for every dollar spent on vaccines. The overall costs, including societal savings from people being sick and off work, are about $16 and some figure that he quoted there. But those two were not included and we may need to taper others. For instance, we've talked about rotavirus, which is another one, which is an expensive vaccine, but where the cost-benefit ratio is not as strong. So in order to make it affordable so we can do something and provide the best protection, first for the children, and then we would like to do some for the adults who don't have other coverage if we can, but looking at the children first. So that was the reason, Senator, through the chair, Senator Egan. Yeah.
Oh, I got promoted, huh?
I really thank Senator Busick for bringing this forward and Senator Olson. Why do we continue this? Why do we have to bring this up frequently? It seems to me like such a benefit for Alaska's children.
Madam Chair, may I respond?
You may.
Senator Egan, through the chair, the reason this is through 2015 is because I wanted to do exactly what Dr. Brown just talked about, and that is take a look at what Washington State has done and another state. It's either Maine or Vermont.
New Hampshire and Idaho, excuse me.
Well, there you go. In any case, other states have worked with their private sector, state, and federal funding to form something that's viable long-term. And I think that will take a few years. That's where I wanted to put in kind of a buffer time there.
Anyone else? Yes.
Through the chair, to Senator Egan. I've had discussions with my counterparts in Washington and New Hampshire where they've had these models that are a little different. In Washington, because they've been hurting so much financially, the state didn't put money up front. New Hampshire did and were reimbursed. But they got the health plans to come in and collaborate. That has an advantage also, a very significant advantage for providers, for physicians, nurse practitioners, and others, in that if the state can buy it all, one, they get it cheaper, but even more important than that, that you can just maintain one supply. If you are buying it in two different places, when Senator Kiesel's in her office, she has to have two refrigerators and two sets of records, so that a lot of providers would just say, I've had enough, I don't want to do it, and it hurts us. So we are doing what we can and working, trying to have a universal program, but hoping we can get it worked out as some of the other states have.
Thank you. Senator Dyson?
Yeah, thank you. Seems to me the questions we don't have answered probably don't need to keep us from moving on this bill. They are, as I remember, financial in nature, and if indeed there is a fiscal vote, which I think there's going to be, then it's a good finance committee referral. I don't mean to be running a railroad train here, but I think there's widespread agreement that this needs to get done and needs to get done in this session. So I won't object if you choose to move it today, because I think the question is going to be answered.
I'm going to say where I am on that. I'm thinking that we probably will not move the bill because I do want them to work out a situation that we know that we're going to fund this program. And if they're having confusion right there, I don't want it to go up to finance and have them have to deal with something that we ought to want to speak out in health and social services. It's an issue that we have to address. That's part of my jurisdiction. I don't just want it to go to finance. That's the only reason I'm not moving it. I also think there's one other person that came in the audience that wanted to testify. Karen Robinson, are you there?
No, I'm just here to listen. Thank you.
You're not here to testify. All right, thank you. Anyone else to testify? I'm willing to hear from the committee as to how you feel about me not moving the bill. But, you know, if they are ready to move this bill, come with the money amount on Wednesday, I'm ready to move it at that point. It's only a couple of days from now, and they did say that might be possible they could have it by Wednesday. And I'd be willing to take it up on Wednesday. It's already been scheduled. It's just a matter of bringing it back. Any other comments?
So
So are you going to agree with what my decision is? Are you okay?
You're the chairman.
All right. Thank you very much for all your testimony, and I hope that we can work this situation out. It will be a win-win situation, not only for us, but for all the children also in the program. We do know that there is another issue that has to be addressed, but first we want to get the funding out there for our children. But we also know that we need to look at this opt-out situation that we are so lenient on and let people do that, because they're endangering our children when they don't get their children vaccinated or get the care that they need. So we need to address that also.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
How do we address that? That 9% does seem to be a pretty high number. Sounds like we're the highest in the nation, if I understood the doctor correctly. I guess you just have to work on an education program.
I'll let the administration speak to that. I can't speak for them. And I don't know if they're at this point ready to answer that. The commissioner was there. I know he said that you would be here. But if you don't want to answer, you can always get back with us later with an answer to his question.
Madam Chair, through the chair, we feel it does need to be education. There is some misperception. There have been items in the medical literature. For example, there was a well-respected British medical scientist who a number of years ago published data that the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine caused autism. And this was widely believed, and is still widely believed. It subsequently came out a couple of years ago that it was not just a misinterpretation of data, it was a deliberate falsification of data by a person who had a bias. And yet this has gone worldwide, and there are still many people who believe that. There really is the issue that I alluded to earlier, that if you have a two-year-old now, it's just about 15 shots that they have to get over those first couple of years. And so that bothers moms and bothers parents, and we try to work with them to work out a schedule. There is a concern about that. There is the cost factor, whereas less than 10 years ago it was about $400 for all the immunizations you needed through age two. It's about $1,800 now. But there is just flat-out some misperception on the part of some people, and education is what we need on the radio, by public health nurses in the communities, by others there. We have the requirement for school entry here for certain vaccines, and that helps quite a bit. But in the implementation of it, a parent can just say, we don't want to do that, whereas Mississippi, which has a law, at least as I read it, basically looks like our law. The Mississippi requirement is that you need a provider's note to excuse the child from receiving it. So they are able to enforce it more than we are in this state.
Madam Chair, I don't mean to prolong this, but
okay.
Thank you. What is the average rate then? You said we were at 9% nationwide.
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, the 9% is the percent of what we call parental hesitancy. That's parents who are reluctant to have their young children, their infants, immunized, and that is the highest in the country at 9%. Our immunization rate right now is about 60%. It's come up a little from what it was. The Alaska Native kids, through the system that's more organized, they have a more uniform health record system, they're around 90%. So that means that the non-Native kids are doing even worse than the statewide average here. We have improved over the last year and a half, but still a long way to go.
All right, thank you. If there's no other things to come before us on these two bills, we will set them aside and bring them back up probably on Wednesday. Bill back on Wednesday. There is an announcement I wanted to say, that the Senate and House Health and Social Services Committee have a joint meeting tomorrow, and it's on the Health Commission's report, is it?
Yeah, it's on Alzheimer's.
On Alzheimer's, and it's tomorrow at 3:30, and it's in room 106. So I hope that you can be there. And with that, we're going to adjourn.